I'm Gregory Gause. I teach political science at the University of Vermont, where I specialize in Middle East politics. And with me today on this Blogging Heads is Shadi Hamid. How are you doing, Shadi?
Not bad, Greg. Good to be debating or discussing with you again. Looking forward to it. My name is Shadi Hamid. I am the Director of Research at the Brookings Doha Center and a Fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. I focus on democratic reform and Islamist movements in the Arab world.
So Shadi and I did a Blogging Heads back in the fall, in which I demonstrated my acute knowledge of the region and my predictive ability by saying that I thought that the authoritarian regimes in the Arab world were pretty stable and that American policy should probably just rely on their stability. Despite this fact, Blogging Heads has now asked me back with Shadi to discuss current events in the Middle East. So, Shadi, why don't I let you do a little gloating since you were right and I was wrong, and then I'll come back and talk a little bit about why I thought I was wrong and what I might still be able to contribute to this discussion.
Well, there's no need to gloat because I didn't see it coming this quickly. I said for a while that autocracies don't last forever. They're going to fall whether we like it or not. It's just a matter of time. So we should get out in front of it and preempt. So I've been saying that, but to be honest, like most people, I was totally surprised at how quickly events moved. I guess all that was needed was a spark, and we got that spark with Tunisia. But you know, I remember January 25th when the protests started in Egypt, and I remember being in touch with some activists. No one even on the day of that, even the people who were organizing it, thought that it would bring out such large numbers and then just in the matter of 18 days lead to a revolution. But I mean, all that said, you know, I think it's just really worth noting how much official Washington and Obama administrations before that really got this wrong in assuming that these countries were going to be stable indefinitely. And Secretary Clinton said on January 25th of all days, the start of the Egyptian uprising, she said, quote unquote, "Our assessment is that the Egyptian regime is stable."
Yeah. I think that it's not just the administration and the political types in Washington. I think a lot of those of us who study Middle East politics got it wrong, too. We've spent a lot of time trying to explain the stability of Arab authoritarianism because that was the dominant political phenomenon in the Arab world for the past 40 years, right? While so many other parts of the world, Latin America, Eastern Europe, even Sub-Saharan Africa, East Asia, had gone through democratic transitions in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, the Middle East, or not the Middle East, because Turkey has certainly gone through a democratic transition, but the Arab world had been remarkably stable in terms of regimes, and although a lot of change had happened beneath the surface, these regimes seemed to be able to ride it out, seemed to be able to, and we spent a lot of time, those of us in the field, especially my generation, I think, trying to explain that level of stability. And I have as we do the forensic, people like me who talked about this stability, I think that some of the things we got wrong were we didn't appreciate the importance of these new technologies. I was one personally who really kind of dismissed them. And I dismissed them because I'd seen, you know, earlier efforts to organize and mobilize based on these new technologies, like the Kafaya movement in Egypt back in 06 and 07, just not be able to succeed. So maybe what I missed on that was the exponential rate of adoption over these last 5 years that so many more people in these countries are adopting, particularly Egypt, which we tend to look at as the model here, I think. I think that that's something that I and we in the field need to think about. I think we need to think more about the relationship between the military and the regimes. We just, and I'll just speak for myself, I just assumed that the military and these regimes were absolutely on the same page, that they were completely intertwined, Tunisia, Egypt. But it's so interesting to see how the militaries in many of these countries, either as a corporate group, moved against the regime when problems started, or the militaries and the security services more generally fragmented, like in Libya, and as happening now in Yemen. So I think that's another thing we need to look at. I think that people like me underestimated the negative consequences of the neoliberal economic reforms that were occurring in Tunisia and Egypt, who of all the Arab countries, they were the ones who received the highest marks from the IMF, from the World Bank, in terms of trying to change their economies in a more Washington consensus way. And I think I underestimated the amount of discontent that caused in terms of the inequalities that introduces into an economy. And I also missed the fact that the people who benefited from those changes, many of them weren't, I assumed that they would be big supporters of a regime like the Mubarak regime, under which they did well. But it turns out that they were, in fact, in the lead in many ways in opposing these regimes. I think Wael El-Ghanem, the Google executive who became, for the Western press, the face of the Egyptian revolution, is very instructive here. I thought he would be the kind of guy who would do very well in a Mubarak regime and would be supportive of it. Instead, he was leading the charge against it. So there's a lot of things that we miss that we have to think about in Middle East studies, I have to think about as someone who analyzes.
But let me just pose this. I mean, after 9/11, I think there was this emerging consensus among conservatives and liberals in the U.S. where we kept on hearing the status quo is untenable. The status quo is untenable over and over. I mean, that was certainly a line the Bush administration advanced quite consistently. and everyone seemed to be more or less on the same page, that that's why we had to have this freedom agenda, because these regimes were not going to be sustained indefinitely. I mean, is that your read on where things were? Because I think that's where the conversation was going. It didn't last a very long time, but I think 2003 to 2005, that really became one of the main narratives in Washington.
I think that's certainly true. As people in Washington were trying to look at kind of the deep reasons why 9/11 happened, there was this focus both on the neoconservative side and on the, if you will, the liberal internationalist side, that then dovetailed in with what had been a relatively consistent discourse from the human rights community, and they all kind of agreed that the reason this happened was because of bad governance and authoritarian rule and the lack of democracy in the Middle East. And I think you nailed it on the head. As soon as the Bush administration, post Iraq War, tried to push other countries, allied countries like Saudi Arabia and Egypt, and the Palestinian Authority into democratic reforms, the administration immediately drew back when it saw that the early elections in Egypt, in the Palestinian Authority, tended to favor Islamist groups like Hamas and the Muslim
Right.
Brotherhood.
Right.
And so then it was kind of put on the shelf in terms of the policy options. And when the Obama administration came in, although the rhetoric was liberal internationalist, the actions on the ground were much more kind of capital R realist, dealing state to state, de-emphasizing the reform agenda. But events on the ground have changed that completely. So maybe we ought to get to the events on the ground.
Exactly. And I think the Obama administration might be going through an identity crisis right now, trying to decide if it is liberal internationalist or interventionist or realist pragmatist. And there seems to be really a push and pull in the administration over Libya. And that's probably what we should jump into right now. That's what's on a lot of people's minds. And I think there's a really interesting debate now in Washington and among Americans in general about what this type of intervention really means, coming not so soon, but coming after the Iraq War. And the memories of the Iraq War are coming back, and that's become one of the main touchstones that we keep on hearing. And I think it's really possible sometimes to overlearn the lessons of the last war, and I worry that's what's happening here. But it seems that the majority opinion, at least among commentators and bloggers, is skeptical or not very supportive of this intervention, and I find myself relatively lonely in this respect, perhaps.
Really?
Is that not your...
I think that there's a fair amount of support for the intervention, at least, you know, from what I can tell. I might be wrong about that, but my read is that you know, you've got this neoconservative, liberal internationalist intellectual alliance on this, and that takes up a lot of the space in Washington. And the people who are kind of skeptical about the intervention, people like me, are kind of the old-fashioned realists. And so it's funny. I thought that I was in the minority. You thought you were in the minority.
That's funny, yeah. You know, certainly the neocons are getting out on this and being very vocal. And this is where we get into a similar dynamic as several years ago, where you have this kind of odd alliance. I disagree very strongly with the neocons on a whole range of matters. But I suppose there is some convergence. I doubt that convergence will last a long time. But I think at least among American liberals, that's where you see a lot of skepticism and opposition, even though there is a whole phrase for liberal interventionists. They're supposed liberals have a proud tradition of advancing human rights and democracy abroad and humanitarian intervention. But obviously the Iraq War shifted that calculus a little bit. But, I mean, why don't we kind of get into what's going on right now with whatever you want to call it, no-fly zone plus this no-drive zone. I mean, the scope of operation has expanded beyond what I think some people were initially calling for. I was calling for really just a no-fly zone a few weeks ago, but then I think what we realized is that a no-fly zone wasn't going to be enough. And in any case, the no-fly zone requires that you take out the air defenses of the Libyan regime anyway.
Yeah, and I think that no-fly zones are not simply about flying, right?
Right.
I mean, we've seen these attacks on air defense and even on artillery in Libya. And I think that realistically, we have to acknowledge that a no-fly zone is not quote-unquote clean, right? There are many strikes on ground targets. Now, I don't believe the government at all when it puts out its own casualty figures, but it's a risk. That collateral damage is always going to be a risk when you're engaged in these kinds of military operations. And I think that we just have to accept that. And I think the administration realized that. I mean, I don't think that they were naive about this.
Right.
To me, the big question is what happens on the ground now that the no-fly zone is on. Does it mean that support for Gaddafi within his own circle begins to fragment as people who have backed him so far in the rebellion say, well, I don't want to go in front of the International Criminal Court. I'm going to stop backing Gaddafi. Or do we get to a situation where we have stalemate, much like there was in Iraq for over a decade, where we had no-fly zones and no-drive zones in the north and a no-fly zone on the south? but that in the South it didn't really keep Saddam Hussein from maintaining some amount of control over southern Iraq. You know, will we end up in a situation where eastern Libya is under control of the rebellion, protected by no-fly zones and no-drive zones, monitored by the United States, France, Britain, maybe NATO, maybe some Arab countries with that, but that in the east, in Tripoli, Gaddafi stays in power? Or is this enough to push him over the edge? And that, to me, is a huge question right now.
Well, I think part of it depends on what the Western mission is really about here, and I think that's where there's been some confusion. Is it about protecting civilians, or is it about ousting Gaddafi? I think when it comes to protecting civilians, the mission has been very successful already, and the reason that I ultimately came out in support of taking action, including no-fly zone and other advanced measures, I mean, at the very end there, on Wednesday and Thursday, we had a situation where Gaddafi's forces were marching right towards Benghazi. They actually got to the city, and there was fighting within the city center, so that's how far it got. And I remember on, I believe it was, you know, Saturday, before the airstrikes had started, I was just kind of following the news and waiting and wondering, is the international community going to act in time, or is it going to be too little too late? And I think at the end of the day, for me, it became an issue of, if Gaddafi overruns Benghazi, we could see vicious reprisals, mass executions against the rebel army, but also members of the interim government. We're talking about a dense urban environment where there could be considerable loss of life. And we're talking about a city of more than 1 million people. So for me, I thought to myself, we might very well have thousands killed if we do nothing. And here you have the rebel army effectively begging for the U.S. and other Western powers to intervene. And I think at some point you have to say, are we going to be comfortable in terms of looking back 5 years from now, in terms of history and legacy, and saying, we stood by and did nothing, and we could have saved thousands of lives. And not only that, I mean, the whole world was looking to us because the UK and France were supporting it, the Arab League got behind it. There was really this emerging international consensus, and everyone was sitting there waiting, saying, where's the U.S. on this? Where's U.S. leadership? And no one was going to take the next step without knowing where we stood. So not only would we have been remembered as standing by idly, we would have been seen as actually preventing other countries from acting. And I think that would have been a very high price to pay in terms of American credibility and reputation in the region and the broader world.
I do think that's the best argument you can make for the policy, both on the humanitarian grounds and on the grounds of credibility, because the administration has been writing a lot of verbal checks in the Middle East, saying that things are unacceptable, including that Muammar Gaddafi remain in power. I believe the President and the Secretary of State have both said that that's unacceptable. And then to stand by and allow him to recapture Benghazi and completely put down the revolt would have been a deleterious to American credibility in the region. But the reason that I came down on the opposite side of this question is that I do wonder about what the long-term consequence here is. I mean, I can see us basically stuck in another Iraq situation, I mean Iraq in the 1990s, where we are in essence supporting and sustaining a regional government, if you will, not under the control of the Libyan government, and in perpetuity, because we can't or won't get rid of Gaddafi himself. Yet we are saying it's unacceptable for him to take Benghazi. Clearly it's not unacceptable for him to control Tripoli. The control of Tripoli wasn't at stake here. And when it was, we didn't act.
Why is it acceptable that he remain in Tripoli?
Yeah, well, I don't know if it is or not. I mean, we'll have to see. As you said, the goals of this seem to be somewhat unclear right now. I tend to think that what the United States and France and Britain want, even though this is not the way the Security Council resolution was phrased, I think what they want is the Gaddafi regime to fall, in the same way that we wanted the Saddam Hussein regime to fall through internal mechanisms when we were keeping the no-fly zone on in the 90s. And so we're willing an end, but we're not supplying the means. You know, we're hoping that the no-fly zone will crack his core support, his ability to hold on even in Tripoli will dissipate. People in the west of Libya will remount the rebellion against him, and that we'll see the end of the regime. But I don't think that's a sure thing at all. So I guess I'm wondering, from your perspective, do you think that this is something that can and should be sustained in terms of a no-fly zone on the model of Iraq in the 1990s, or would you like to see even more vigorous intervention to get rid of the regime?
What would you mean by more vigorous intervention?
Well, it could be expanding the target list for the no-fly zone. It could be stronger information.
Right.
Operations, but an open call for people to overthrow Saddam,
yeah.
An open threat that people who are Saddam, there's on, Gaddafi, an open threat to take people who are in the top levels of his regime to the International Criminal Court unless they abandon him. And then eventually, you know, armed supplies to the rebels and perhaps even special forces on the ground.
Yeah. Well, I mean, here's the thing. I mean, it's interesting you bring up the Iraq comparison and talking about, you know, mid-90s to late 90s where it just kept on going on and on. Maybe another way to make that comparison is the early 90s where you had the Shia uprising, where the Shia opposition revolted and was close to defeating Saddam, and they were calling for international help. And the first Bush administration had a chance to support them in that but decided not to, and because of that, Saddam was able to stay in power, and the rest is history. So I think mm-hmm. that's instructive, too, that, you know, sometimes when you have the chance, it's better to do it, especially when you have rebels who are asking for that support and actually have the potential to win. And I think that is really one of the more tragic blots on our history, where we essentially betrayed them on the ground because they were expecting our help, and the Bush administration actually encouraged people in Iraq to revolt against their leader. But to go to, you know, what I would like to see, I mean, the UN resolution authorizes all necessary measures short of occupation. So there is a lot we can do if we decide we want to do it. And I think it's obviously not just a matter of protecting Benghazi, but giving the rebels a chance to regroup. And at some point, they're going to start moving westward towards Tripoli. That's a long trek, obviously, and there's a lot of cities in between. But what that means is that the Western coalition forces are going to have to move along with the rebels, protecting them as they continue moving in that direction and hopefully recapturing more cities from the Gaddafi forces. I mean, that's a delicate mission. There's a lot of potential pitfalls there. It's not going to be easy, but I don't really see what the other option is. We don't want to see a divided Libya where you have, you know, Benghazi interim government on one side and Gaddafi on the other. That's not going to be sustainable, and that's not going to benefit anyone. So at some point, if we're in this, we're going to have to be in this, I think. Mm-hmm. And I think that's actually what maybe some people were worried about, and I guess that's what people would call mission creep. But I don't see what the other option is here. The rebels have a very clear goal. They want to get rid of Gaddafi. So that means we have to arm them, and that can be done through intermediaries. That can be done through Egypt. I mean, we have to give them the appropriate equipment and firepower where they're really able to compete with Gaddafi's forces. But obviously, I think one red line is no U.S. boots on the ground, and I do understand that, and it's been important for Obama to emphasize that over and over, because Arab public opinion matters here, and we don't want a situation where it starts to look like something akin to an occupation. So I think there are limits to our involvement, certainly. I mean, I think a best-case scenario is that as the rebels move westward, Gaddafi comes under increasing pressure, we see the factions, and then he says, fine, I'm willing to step down or leave the country or whatever. But knowing what we know about Gaddafi, he seems like the kind of person who might fight till the very end.
That's my fear, is that this will require an enormous amount of violence and force. And I think that, you know, I think you were very honest in setting out the costs here. But I wonder if it's a misnomer now to call this a no-fly zone, at least according to the Shadi Hamid plan for Libya, because it's not a no-fly zone, right? We are flying air support for a rebel force. Right, because if we're to say that we're protecting the rebel force, right, is different than saying we're protecting civilians or trying to protect civilians. We are presumably providing the air cover for them to take on the forces of the Gaddafi regime, and that's a very active involvement in Libyan domestic politics. I think you've been very honest about why you think that's important to do and why you think it's in American interest to do it. My pushback on that is that I think that it gets us involved in a level of Libyan domestic politics that I'm not sure in the long run serves American interests. But that opens up actually a bigger debate about how to deal with these upheavals in the Arab world. And if you don't mind, unless you have something else you want to say about Libya, let me shift focus to another
sure.
really hard case that we in the United States are doing taking the opposite position on, and that's
sure.
Bahrain, your neighbor, your Qatari neighbor, Bahrain.
Right.
You know, here we have a situation where the administration called for negotiations, was very firm with the Bahraini government when they first used violence against the protesters, what was it, 3 weeks ago now, I think. It was seems like a long time ago, right?
Yeah.
But now the Bahraini government, with the support of Saudi Arabia and the other monarchical states in the Gulf Cooperation Council, has basically put down the protests in Bahrain. And the United States, you know, there's no talk about no-fly zones in Bahrain. There's no talk about protection of civilians in Bahrain. And, you know, we don't have to be naive. We know exactly why that is. Bahrain is in the oil patch, doesn't have that much oil itself, but it's in the oil patch. And that even though I think it's absolutely true that the protesters in Bahrain were voicing national demands, not sectarian demands, and were voicing a Bahraini-centered program for political change, any kind of move that lessened the power of the regime in Bahrain would be seen regionally as a victory for Iran because of the sectarian split within Bahrain, where you have a Shia majority population and a Sunni ruling family. And the United States, while we were critical of the Bahraini government's moves to suppress the protests, we're not doing nearly as much as in Libya. Do you think that we should be doing more in Bahrain? And if so, what do you think it should be?
Well, certainly. And this is, you know, my broad critique of the Obama administration. I mean, the U.S. has been behind the curve in nearly every single one of these countries since the uprising started in Tunisia several months ago. We were behind the curve in Tunisia. We only really started siding with the protests against Mubarak at the very end. In Egypt, we've backed effectively the Bahraini regime, the Saudis, Jordan, Morocco, and saying, we're with you. We're willing. We're not going to undermine you. We want you to engage in reform. We want you to address the demands of your people, but we support you as rulers in your country. That was the message that was sent to many of these monarchies in the Gulf and elsewhere. And, of course, there are reasons for that, but that really puts us on the wrong side of a regional change. And I think we really have an opportunity now, and I hope it's not too late, for the U.S. to realign its policy in a fundamental way and say to itself, again, these autocracies are not going to last forever. The Arab public matters. What Arabs think matters. And we should be seen as a positive force in the region. Because, again, this gets us back to the long debate about American policy. We've been supporting repressive regimes for more than 5 decades, and it hasn't worked. It's gotten us to where we are now, where the region is falling apart before our very eyes. That's what the so-called stability paradigm, in my view, gave us. So when are we finally going to be ready to shift? I'm not saying that we throw these rulers under the bus. That's not realistic. It's not pragmatic. That's not in U.S. interest. But putting more pressure on them at the very least. I mean, what we saw in Yemen, which is a country we give considerable assistance to, on Friday was an outright massacre where 52 peaceful protesters were just gunned down from snipers on rooftops. I mean, how does that make us look in the region where people say, well, they're willing to intervene in Libya because they don't like Gaddafi. But when the Yemenis massacre their own people, they express concern and disappointment. That makes us look very, very bad. And again, it gets us back to this issue of credibility. How do we want people to view us? And right now our policy, quite frankly, is a mess of contradictions.
I accept the contradictions point, but I think it's inevitable that there are going to be contradictions. I think that if we believed that all of the authoritarian regimes in the Middle East and all the American allied authoritarian regimes were going to collapse sometime in the near future, it would, of course, make perfect sense for us to get ahead of the curve on that. But my analysis is that while I think Ali Abdullah Saleh in Yemen is gone, I think his regime is on its last legs. But, of course, I'm the same guy who predicted that Mubarak would be in good shape the last time we talked, so take that for what it's worth. But, you know, we saw in Yemen not just the violence that was used. And it's interesting violence, you know, because to be perfectly cold-blooded about it, if he had used a lot more violence, you know, on the model of Hafez al-Assad's regime in Syria in the 1980s when it put down the Islamist revolt, or even the Algerian government's dealings with the Islamist uprising in the 1990s, he might have been able to consolidate himself. But he's using just enough violence to make people mad and not enough to actually solve his problems. So the fact that he fired his whole cabinet either yesterday or today, and from what one hears, he fired them because they were all on the verge of resigning. And even his own tribe, the Sanhan tribe, in Yemen seems to be turning against him. He seems to be on his last legs, and there's no reason that the U.S. should stick with a guy who's on his last legs. But the Saudi regime, the Bahraini regime, they seem to have the resources, at least so far, to maintain themselves against this wave of popular upheaval through some amount of violence, certainly in Bahrain, through the use of the enormous financial reserves and resources that they have. And thus, we're confronted with this issue of how does one deal, and let's say the Saudis are the most important of this crowd with their huge oil resources and their regional role. How does one deal with the Saudis on a reform agenda when they see reform as fundamentally undermining their system, and they argue that our notion of reform only increases Iranian power in the region? And one can disagree with their analysis, but that's what they think. And so how does one deal with them? Do we distance ourselves from them and thus reduce leverage that we might have with the Saudis on oil questions, on other regional questions, in order that if and when the Saudis become unstable, we might be in a better position to deal with what comes after? But the short-term and even medium-term cost of that is reducing our influence with them. This kind of brings up the larger issue, and I'll kick it back to you on this one, about a rethink of American policy here. I mean, my read of your analysis of this is that the takeaway from the upheavals in the Arab world should be that the United States should prioritize political reform everywhere in the region, even if that leads to change in regimes that we've had pretty good relations with, and even if it means the reduction of our day-to-day influence with those regimes if they do stick around. Am I reading it right, Shadi?
Yeah, more or less. You know, just to be honest, I think you can't have your cake and eat it in the Middle East. Sometimes you have to make difficult choices. So I am very much aware that there may be short-term trade-offs if we have this broad rethink of policy that I'm suggesting. It's not going to be easy. It might be messy. There might be costs in the short term. But that's the whole, I mean, bold action requires taking risks. If it was risk-free, it wouldn't be bold, right?
Right.
So, I mean, Saudi is a little bit delicate, and I don't think that's an area we should be pushing very hard, simply because there haven't been strong demands from the population yet. But where populations do rise up, where tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people take to the streets demanding their freedom, I think that's where we have to have a stronger stand. And unfortunately, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on your viewpoint, we're not a normal country. We're not, I don't know, France or Botswana or whatever. We're not concerned strictly with our national interest narrowly defined. We're one of the last countries that claims to stand for something beyond the nation state. And people can disagree with that orientation, but that's who we claim to be, and that's who we wanted to be or pretend to be. And I think that matters for something, because when the Bahrainis are out there sacrificing their lives for freedoms, or the Egyptians in Tahrir Square, they don't look to China or Russia for support or solidarity. They look to the U.S. and to the West more broadly. And I think that's been one of the interesting kind of themes of the last couple months, that as much as people ostensibly hate U.S. policy, there's still a part of them that wants to believe in America's promise. It's this kind of schizophrenic love-hate thing. And that's why there were so many signs in English in Tahrir Square, and why people were calling quite openly, you know, on Al Jazeera from the square, saying, where is the international community? Why isn't the U.S. putting more pressure on Mubarak to leave? Why did the Bahrainis have a protest in front of the U.S. embassy the other week calling on the U.S. to essentially help them in their struggle? So, you know, again, maybe that's not realistic of them to think that we're going to be able to offer that support. But successive U.S. administrations, from Clinton to George W. Bush to even Obama, have said, we support the universal democratic aspirations of Arabs. We are behind the right to peacefully protest. So we're already declaring a certain kind of policy and solidarity there. So when people actually say, okay, fine, we're going to peacefully protest, then we say, well, actually, we're kind of going to change our mind now. And I mean, of course, this gets us into the perpetual tension in U.S. policy between ideals and interests. And I think that we're a different sort of country in that regard.
Yeah, I guess my takeaway from the upheavals in the Arab world is that not just that there's a schizophrenia there, but there's a schizophrenia here too, right? There's a schizophrenia in the United States, which you highlighted in what you just said. The difference between you and me on this is that I think my bottom line of all this is that we should try to become a more normal country. That is to say, we have, since the end of the Cold War, progressively gotten more and more involved in the domestic politics of states in the greater Middle East, whether it's from Afghanistan to Iraq, now to Libya, which I think that we will, to one extent or another, own, not in the same sense that we've owned Afghanistan and Iraq, but we're going to be much, much more involved in the domestic politics of Libya. And I just wonder if, A, we have the resources to do this, and, B, whether we would do it well. So I have practical concerns about this larger impulse in American policy to get more involved in the domestic politics of these states. And I have kind of prudential and if you will, ideational objections to it, that I just wonder if we should be getting so involved. I think that we're spending a lot of our resources on issues that in the long run are not that important for American interests. I think that we're spending down a lot of our blood and treasure in the Middle East on issues that are not central to the long-term future of American interests in the world. And here's where I think you and I just, you know, we just have very different takes on how the U.S. should deal with this. But it's something, and I fully acknowledge that if we're going to step back from the Middle East, which would be my kind of bottom line of rethinking American policy in the region as a result of these Arab upheavals, is to step back from the region and not be so interested. I'm not talking about isolationism. We have strategic interests here, and one thing we're good at is kind of protecting strategic interests, preventing one a regional power from invading another or trying to dominate the region. But what we're not good at, I think, is directing the domestic politics of these countries and having any confidence that once we're involved, the end result will be something that we think would be good. We still don't know, of course, what the end results are going to be of these Arab upheavals, even in the two places, Tunisia and Egypt, where they've been the most successful in removing regimes and where I think they probably have the best chance of transitioning to something like a relatively stable democracy. I mean, there are obstacles in both of these cases, right? But I think these are the two places in the Arab world that have the best chance because of the homogeneity of the populations, because of the the strength of state institutions. I mean, you have to have a real state if you're going to have democracy. And Libya is not a real state. Gaddafi ran it as this kind of shambolic personal patronage network and bizarre set of popular committees backed up with huge security forces. I mean, Tunisia and Egypt have real states, have real histories, and don't have profound social cleavages, sectarian, ethnic. I mean, the Christian-Muslim problem in Egypt is real, but the Coptic population is 10%, and they're not a threat, quote-unquote, to any regime. So even in the two places where there's the best opportunity, I think, for stable democratic transition, we still don't know if we're going to get it. And frankly, I don't think there's much America can do one way or another to try to guide that.
Okay. I mean, I take all those points. I guess let's talk about hard interests. I mean, I don't want people to misconstrue my position as being – you know, very kind of, you know, fluffy democracy, human rights. I think there's a very strong...
You're a fluffy guy. You're a fluffy guy, Shad.
I think there's a very strong argument to be made that having Arab democracies is going to be in our hard strategic interest, maybe not right away, but down the road. And I guess it really depends how you define interest, and I guess that's where people come, you know, on different sides of this. But if you can kind of just imagine a Middle East that was largely democratic, where people actually had outlets to express their grievances, where governments were more effective because they didn't represent just a few leaders at the top, but they represented their own populations. And that's why I think countries like Turkey play a constructive mediation role in the region, because they're not just about regime survival. They don't care about only that. They're part of a bigger thing. They have the support of their constituencies, and their constituencies want them to play an active role in the regional stage. And we can criticize Turkish foreign policy all we want, but they do help bring different sides together because they're friends with both sides of the so-called Arab Cold War, the pro-American side, but also the Iran Hezbollah Syria axis, or whatever you want to call it. So, I mean, these democracies would be countries that we would disagree with. We would get in fights with them, just like we get in fights with France. But they would be stable because they have the consent of their own people and they are legitimate. So we don't have to worry about them falling. And if these new democracies see that America stood by them as they were going through their transition, as they were leaving authoritarian rule and trying to have something more representative, I think for the first time there would be real goodwill towards America, but only if we were consistent. It's not going to be enough just to have it right on Libya or Libya and Egypt. But if we can show that we have a consistent application of our principles, then these new democracies would say, wow, America's really changed. America got this right, and we see them as both a friend and a partner. I think 20 or 30 years now, that would put us in very good stead.
Yeah, I guess my pushback on that is that I think Turkey is an excellent example here, right? We have, I think Turkey is a great model too, and it's a model for what I'm talking about, which is the stepping back, right? I don't think that we should be intervening in the domestic politics of states in the Arab world to encourage democracy, but I don't think we should be intervening to prevent democracy either. I think that our rules should be, look, we can't save you from your own people, and that unstable allies are useless to us. And I think that this is the question we're going to be facing in Bahrain. In terms of possibly stepping back, if low-level unrest continues and that it targets the American facilities in Bahrain, which it's never done up till this time, then you know, Bahrain as an ally is not very useful to us. We'll see how that develops. But the thing about Turkey, right? There's lots of things we disagree with about Turkish foreign policy, but I say this is a democratic regime. It follows its own interests, and we can live with that. We're the strongest country in the world, and we can live with democratic regimes in the larger Middle East following their own policies on issues of Arab-Israeli questions, on other issues, and that means that we're not going to get what we want all the time. But we can live with that. That's part of the moving back for me. But I also think that the where I might disagree with you is that if the United States were very strongly supportive of democratic change, that would mean there would be a long-run reservoir of goodwill in these countries toward the United States that would affect their foreign policy toward us. I tend to think foreign policy issues get made less on public opinion and more on you know, perceptions of interest. Now, that's, of course, defined by your ideology, your beliefs, defined by, in democratic systems, what your constituents want. But I just don't think we would buy that much goodwill in the short term if there were regime changes. But I don't know how much long-term goodwill we'd buy. If we are going to continue a policy of strong support for Israel, which I think we will because of our own political system and our own interests, you know, in many of these states, Turkey's an excellent example, where public opinion becomes more important in the formation of public policy. That's going to push against the United States and strong relations with the United States. Now, again, I say I can live with that, but we have to recognize that that's the price in the immediate, and I would say probably medium and long terms, to a strong democracy promotion effort. So I'm a step back guy.
So
think of the place strategically.
Okay, so let me just push you a little. So by that, do you mean something similar to what our existing policy has been up until now, this kind of realist pragmatist approach, or are you talking about something somehow different?
I think it's different from what we've seen since certainly since 9/11, where we've had, and I'm not saying that you favor boots on the ground to change regimes, but we've seen boots on the ground to change regimes in both Afghanistan and in Iraq, and we're seeing an application of military force in Libya that I think in the long run, more than long run, is meant to change the regime. I'm more for, perhaps less support for authoritarian allies. If you can maintain yourself, that's fine. We'll deal with you. Right? And I think that's very much been our case with Saudi Arabia. We've protected them from external threats, but there's not much we can do to help the Saudis against their own internal problems. And they have to deal with them according to their own
What about countries that receive considerable aid from us? I mean, how do we be neutral in those cases? Well, that's Morocco, Jordan, Yemen. Yeah. We can't just step back because we're part of it.
We've lost Yemen, I think.
Okay.
I think that's done. I don't think that's a big shift, frankly. I mean, our alliance with Ali Abdullah, alliance is the wrong thing. Our support for Ali Abdullah Saleh was completely instrumental. And if the next government that takes over in Sana'a is willing to cooperate with us against al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, I think they'll get the same level of aid, if they want to. Morocco and Jordan, I think, are interesting questions here. They're the two places where we're confronted with the biggest issues here, because they're the two places, and Bahrain, frankly, because of the military base.
Yeah.
As you said, Morocco and Jordan are places where there haven't been the kinds of huge public outpourings, demonstrations to be sure, but in the thousands, not the tens of thousands. If I understand the news from Morocco, which I don't follow all that closely, and my take on Jordan, which I do try to follow more closely, is that there's serious demonstrations, but we're not talking about outpourings on the level of Tunisia, Egypt, or Bahrain proportionally.
Right.
Bahrain, you have 20% of the citizen population of the country out
of
certain demonstrations. It's absolutely remarkable. And so I'm willing to stick with the monarchies in Jordan and Morocco, as you said, as long as they, here you and I think are pretty similar, as long as they're able to handle their own business.
That's not really.
I think the difference.
Jordan.
Right. Well, you would like to push them more than I would, but you did say, I think if I heard you correctly earlier, that one criteria for you is when you said, well, the Saudis are different, we shouldn't be pushing. Maybe that's not where we should have a lot of focus. Is that when the evidence for you of a popular desire for change is taking to the street, right? And you would agree that in Morocco and Jordan we haven't seen the same level of popular discontent measured by the willingness to take to the street.
Not as much, but still sizable.
Okay.
Yeah, I think they're...
Okay, so,
yeah, that's definitely part of it. But also, because Morocco and Jordan are more dependent on the U.S., I mean, Jordan, I believe, is either the second or third largest per capita recipient of USA, depending on how you calculate it. I mean, we have leverage there. I mean, Jordan is a vulnerable country, and they depend on their ties to the West.
Right. And how would you push them, Shadi?
I think we have to be talking about a new method of foreign assistance where we make economic and military aid conditional on political reform and meeting a series of benchmarks. And if they can't meet them, we have to talk seriously about reconsidering the aid packages. But if that could...
Those benchmarks, right? Those benchmarks would be very, very specific about the way they run their domestic politics, because by some general benchmarks, the Jordanians, they have elections. You and I, are probably agreed about the quality of those elections and the context in which those elections take place. But they have elections to a parliament. And so it would really be down to the micromanaging level what those benchmarks would be, right?
No, we would just... I mean, I think these are general overall principles that your election should be for a legislative body that actually has power, that you should try to move to a constitutional monarchy, because absolute monarky is not sustainable in the long run.
But the Jordanian regime would say we are a constitutional monarchy. Right? They would.
Right, but objectively speaking, they're not.
Okay. By constitutional monarchy, then, you basically mean a European-style monarchy where the monarch reigns but has very little political input.
Something along those lines. Maybe it doesn't have to be as powerless as the European model, but something quite different than what we have now. And it doesn't have to happen tomorrow, but it could happen over the longer term. I mean, another way to maybe incentivize this is not to cut aid, but to offer more aid to countries that are willing to embark on real sustained reform and say, listen, we have a democracy endowment here, considerable sums of money for countries that want to work in partnership with the U.S. to see how they can move along the path of democracy. And for me, maybe this is where we differ as well. For me, I don't see this as an imposition in domestic politics, because I consider democracy to be a non-negotiable. I consider it to be universal and appropriate for all peoples and all countries. And I don't really see it as having a particular ideological value. In a sense, I almost consider democracy as a neutral basis for discussion. I think where we can talk about domestic imposition is if I'm going into Jordan and saying, listen, it should be secular, we want to see an Islamic flavor, we want to see you adopt this electoral system, that's for Jordanians to decide. But I think democracy is something that all of us agree is a good thing.
Yeah. I don't want to be misunderstood here. I would never say that democracy was not appropriate or something like that for the Arab world. I think Arabs can handle democracy just fine. My soundbite on this has always been that it's not that Arabs can't handle democracy. It's that Washington can't handle the kinds of regimes that Arab democracy.
So maybe we should start being able to handle that. Maybe we should just address that.
Well, I'm more than willing to do that, but by stepping away, okay. Not by getting more involved. And that means also by living with authoritarians if they can sustain themselves. And I think that that's where we differ, is that I wouldn't use these kinds of benchmarks. And your benchmarks are very political. It's interesting to point out, and we probably should wrap up. We're coming up to the one-hour mark here. Your benchmarks are political. We did have in the Millennium Challenge grants benchmarks that were economic and political. And by the economic standards, the Tunisians and the Egyptians were, of course, the ones furthest out on the kind of economic change we wanted them to do. And it came back to bite them. And I think that one of the takeaways from the upheaval in the Arab world is going to be that leaders are going to be much more reluctant to follow Washington consensus economic reform policies than they were before, because they think the political implications of those are going to be negative.
That's a really interesting point. But maybe that's also an argument for privileging political reform over economic reform as well.
Right. Well, that would be a change in what we've been doing in the past. So I'm about talked out, and I'm sure that people who've listened this long are about listened out. Shadi, do you have anything you'd like to close with? I'll just say happy Nowruz to our listeners who are Iranians and Kurds and from, as they say in the academic world, Persianate societies. Nowruz is the new year, and I believe it started yesterday. It corresponds with the beginning of spring. So happy Nowruz to our listeners in the Persianate world.
Yeah, anyway, let me say thanks so much for this discussion. I really enjoyed it, as always, and hopefully we can do this again in the future, I hope.
Yeah, if I keep getting things wrong, though, Shadi, they'll stop asking me.
We'll have to wait and see then. Yeah.
Nice talking to you.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Right.